This is the Mindvox podcast hosted by Claire Jacobs. Mindvox is a space to talk about our minds, mental health and neurodivergence, so we cover topics that can be of a sensitive or triggering nature. We will always highlight the topics we cover in each episode's show notes description. Please note, we're not medical experts, we're only experts of our own mental health and neurodivergent experiences. To find out more about the pod or to contact us, search for us on Instagram, Facebook and Twitter as MindvoxPod. Hi everyone, today I've got with me Carrie Cairns, who is a veterinary CPD tutor and student hypnotherapist. They were a pet bereavement counsellor for 22 years and are currently training as a hypnotherapist. Carrie has two children and is a late diagnosed autistic who uses they, them pronouns. They were misdiagnosed with depression and anxiety before getting an autism diagnosis, and their experience within the mental health system inspired them to now train as a hypnotherapist. Carrie has come onto the podcast to talk about their late diagnosis journey, why they think functioning labels can be harmful, and their experience of the mental health system, both diagnosed and undiagnosed. Hi, Carrie. How are you?
Hi, I'm not too bad, thank you. How are you?
I'm okay. Did I get any of that wrong?
Oh, okay. No, it's all good. Yeah.
Okay. Brilliant.
Yeah, all good.
So if we could just start really by the obvious question of your journey, because I found you on, I think it was Facebook, where you were talking openly about being misdiagnosed with depression and anxiety. And I just wondered, where did that start? What was going on for you at the time? Was it childhood, adulthood?
Yeah. So as a child, I'd always been sort of like the weird kid at school. Didn't find it very easy to make friends. I didn't understand the rules of the playground. And I was just quite happy to just sit in the gardens playing with ladybirds and looking for cool rocks. Then playing the games that the other kids were playing. And I got bullied a lot at primary school and secondary school because I was seen as being very quiet and a bit odd. And I never really understood, as I said, like the rules of the playground or how to fit in. And when I was about 11, I started to feel quite depressed, quite down. And obviously, because of my age, it wasn't really sort of picked up, I suppose. It was just, oh, she's just a kid, you know, all kids have a hard time at high school, sort of thing. But as I got older, I started having more bouts of what I thought was depression, just very low mood, thoughts of not wanting to be here anymore, feeling like a burden. And at 17, I actually made an attempt to take my own life because I was feeling so low. And when I went to the doctors as a teen and as an adult, it was just written off as, oh, you're anxious or you're depressed. We'll give you some antidepressants at me. And away I went with my prescription and thought, oh, these will do it. This is what it is. And I've been on various antidepressants over the years. One set of antidepressants I had after my attempt were, those at venlafaxine, I think they were. And I reacted really badly to those, ended up in hospital because I was hallucinating, really reacted badly. And then I was on citalopram, and I found that the antidepressants didn't really work for me. They didn't seem to be alleviating any symptoms. They just made me numb. And that was scarier, I think, just the thought that I'd actually gone back to the doctor and said, look, I've got a small child. I'm literally at a point where I'm on these tablets and they just make me feel like I don't care about anything. I said the house could be burning down around my ears and I'd just be like, okay, it is what it is. And that worried me because I thought surely these should be working, should be helping. And I just felt like a zombie. I just felt really numb and worse than I did before I started taking them. And I just started to think maybe it was something more than depression and anxiety. It didn't feel like that was the right diagnosis for me. And I started looking into the way I behaved and the way I thought and the way I spoke. And autism kept cropping up. And I did a couple of online tests and they all flagged high. And it wasn't until I was in my early 40s, I'm 42 now, and I was 40, 41 when I got diagnosed, that I realised that actually this was me, this fit me. And then I decided to ask for a referral for an autism assessment, and luckily got an appointment quite quickly and was diagnosed with autism spectrum condition. it's been a long journey to get to this point.
Sounds like a very long journey, but sadly, quite a lot of us seem to be having similar experiences. When you mentioned autism cropped up a lot, or sometimes over this long period of time, was that by professionals? Who was saying that it might be that?
It was myself, really, because I was trying to figure out why I didn't fit in, and I was trying to figure out why I struggled so much with social interactions, why people thought I was a bit odd, and why I found life so difficult. And so I do a lot of research and online, and I was tapping into Google, you know, what does it mean if you think like this, or what does it mean if you act like this? And let's say autism would come up in my searches, and my uncle was autistic. He had quite high support needs, and so I knew that it ran in families, and I had my suspicions that some other close family members may be autistic as well. And I've bought lots of books on how to read body language, how to speak to people, because I thought, well, it's obviously me, I'm obviously just not getting it somehow. And I thought, I'll just look into the autism and just see what the criteria is. And I found the Samantha, I can't remember.
Is it Samantha Craft?
Yeah, that's what, yeah. And I looked at her website and all the criteria, and it was like she'd written about me, and I was ticking all the boxes. I'm like, that's me. That's got to be it. You know, there's nothing wrong with me. I'm autistic. And then everything in my life just seemed to make sense. Looking back as a child, all my childhood interests, been into geology and animals, and you know, reading quite a lot and at a young age, and missing the point as well was a big thing. I'd be talking to people and I'd say something that was quite adult for my age and something quite in depth, and people would be looking at me like, that's not what we're talking about, it's actually this. And I realized that one of the criteria was you look at the smaller details and focus on smaller details rather than the bigger picture. And I was like, well, yeah, what else do you do, sort of thing. So when I looked at the Samantha Craft website and all the information, and I'd done the online tests, I was like, this fits. For a few months, I sort of self-diagnosed and joined a few online Facebook groups. And people had said, you know, people that aren't autistic don't question whether or not they're autistic. So if you think you might be, you probably are. And I thought, well, there's no harm in identifying as such if that everything seems to point to that. And I started to make accommodations for myself based on that. And then I thought, I really want a professional diagnosis. I need to know for sure. And so I get that validation from a professional that I was right, because for so long I'd been misunderstood. I finally wanted someone to say, actually, yeah, you're right, and this is how it is.
And that makes a hell of a lot of sense to me. I think I'm currently in that position of recognizing a lot of autistic traits in myself. You know, I had the ADHD diagnosis over a year ago, mm-hmm. and even the psychiatrist then said you might want to explore, you know, autism. So mm-hmm. went down a loophole.
Yeah.
Still in that loophole. And like you said, Samantha Craft's list is huge. So mm-hmm. make yourself a cup of tea before you read that one, because it's going to be a long one. But it's really detailed, and all these things that you just would never associate with autism from the way society talks about it.
Oh yeah,
it's crazy, isn't it, the amount of stuff on there. I was like, that's autism, I did not know that. And yeah. And it's brilliant, and obviously not many people will identify every single one, because there's hundreds of things she puts on there, but there's a lot there to sort of get an idea as to whether you resonate, isn't it? And yeah. And I think she kind of particularly it's more sort of catered and geared towards female autism, which sadly mm-hmm. doesn't have much research in it, does it, still to this day? But hopefully that will change. And then it's got all that stuff in it that, you know, is so different. Because I think it's what I find strange is that autism is seen stereotypically as a male thing, just like ADHD.
Yeah, it's sad, really, because there's a whole generation of what they call the lost girls. And although I identify as non-binary now, biologically I'm female, but because we mask, well, not easily, because it does take a lot out of us mentally, physically, I think because we adapt. I mean, I used to call myself a chameleon. I said I'm a social chameleon. I said I'm like a really bad chameleon, because I can't fit in no matter how hard I try. And that was one of the things that really made me want to look into autism as well, was because I found myself acting and speaking and dressing like whatever peer group I was in. But then I'd say to my mum, I try and act like everyone else, but then the real me, in air quotes, comes out and I can't keep it up and I don't know what I'm doing wrong. And I realised that this was another thing, and it was masking. I was trying to fit in and it didn't work because, one, I couldn't keep it up, and two, because I'm autistic, you can't hide that. You can't get rid of it, and I wouldn't want to. But what I mean is, trying to blend in with other people that were either realistic or neurotypical, I found that I was having to work so hard to act like other people that it got to a point where I'd say or do something that was really me. And the difference between myself and my peers was glaringly obvious. And, you know, over the years, I've never really had a lot of friends, apart from when I got to like sixth form and I met a great bunch of people. And I've heard that neurodivergent people tend to congregate, you know, we tend to find each other. And they say, you know, if you're neurodiverse, then have a look at your friends group, because 9 times out of 10, they're all going to be somewhere. And looking around my friends, I'm like, do you know what? Actually, yeah, I think that's why we all get on so well, because I think we are all neurodiverse. Not necessarily. I think there's a couple of people in my friends group that I think may be autistic, but majority, I would say, are like ADHD or OCD and dyslexia and other neurodiverse things. And it made sense that this is why I got on with these people so well and I could be truly me, and why I struggled so much with my peers at primary school and high school, because, you know, they were holistic. And, you know, and back in like the 80s and the 90s, if you were autistic, then chances are you would have gone to a special school. I don't like that term, special school, but they were sent to a school that would have met their needs. And like you say, like a lot of girls, a lot of females or female presented people get missed, and I got missed for 42 years because I hid who I was, because society had led me to think that I was the problem, that I was doing something wrong, and that's why I wasn't fitting in. It was obviously me. And what bothered me so much about being misdiagnosed, I mean, maybe I was depressed, maybe depression was there and some anxiety, but I don't think that that was the sole diagnosis. I think maybe I was depressed, but it was because of autism, or because I was in burnout. And looking into burnout, I realized that that's what that was. That period when I was like 17 and I was really struggling was burnout. I'd spent so long not being accepted by society, and then suddenly I'd met a group of people that there were like, I don't know, there was about over 10 of us at one point in the friends group who accepted me for me. And I think I just, and with the struggles with college, because I was doing the GMVQ course, so it was a lot of self-study, which I loved, like, you know, obviously, you know, artistic, I love my research, you know, I'm ticking the, you know, the stereotypical box here. But because there was a lot of work to do and I wasn't getting the accommodations I actually needed, that I didn't know I needed, I got to a point where I just sank deeper into what I thought was depression, but was actually burnout. And that's what, you know, led to that night where I tried to, you know, stop the pain permanently. So yeah, it's quite sad, really. I mean, my daughter's 7 and I truly feel that she's neurodiverse. I strongly think that she may be autistic, but also I do feel that she has ADHD. But because she's not displaying the characteristic, well, I say characteristic, because she's not displaying traits like she would if she was a boy. Because my son was diagnosed at 5 and he's now 14 and my daughter's 7. And they've said, well, she's not like this at school. And I said, yeah, but she won't be if she's masking. She'll act differently at school. And so I'm fighting for my daughter to be reassessed, because I don't want her to end up like me. I don't want her to spend majority of her adulthood feeling that she was wrong somehow, that there's something wrong with her, because there isn't. She's brilliant. And I'm bringing her up as if she was autistic or has ADHD, because as far as I'm concerned, I think she does, but it does no harm to put those accommodations in place and give her the support I could have done with if I'd have known sooner. And it seems to be working for her, you know, and for all of us, but, you know.
And that's the thing, isn't it? I think even if you don't manage to get an, you know, a diagnosis for her, or, you know, the waiting lists are huge at the moment. Mm. If you don't get one anytime soon, if you in your core know or deeply suspect that she is divergent, then there is no harm in you educating her about what it is, looking at what her individual needs are and her traits and how she can help herself and others around her can help her. You know, you don't need the label if you can't get it, you know, what do you do? So I think you're doing it the perfect way. Mm. And like you said, it's really hard. It can be a battle. So my son, for instance, is male, but seems to very much present like me. So when you're trying to look at things like you said, I've actually had people say, his teacher and Cam say, but he's really academic, when I've questioned neurodivergence. And I'm like, what does academia got to do with things like ADHD? Autism, you know, there's this assumption that you're only good at maths. I mean, he's very good at maths, but aside from that, he's also very good at every subject, like I was. Yeah. So I kind of, it's that battle, isn't it? But if, like I said, I don't have any labels, he may not be, but when we look at how genetic it is, when I'm seeing things that I see in myself, and I do have one of the diagnosis official, I start to go, well, maybe I need to change things. So my question now is, what changes did you make for your son? Obviously, he's a teenager now and he's going through those years. So I've kind of got two questions, really. Like, he is diagnosed, and what changes did you make for him and your daughter? But also, what changes have you made now he's changing into a young man? And because I imagine you're constantly having to adjust your parenting as they go through each stage.
So like with my son, we learned that he needed more structure to his days. And so as he was growing up, once he got diagnosed, we realised that we couldn't just spring sudden changes onto him. If we were at the park or something, for instance, we couldn't just say, right, we're going now. We had to give him a countdown and we'd say, right, you know, in 5 minutes. We learned to break things down into steps and break his day down into a structure. We'd have to say things like, okay, in the morning when you wake up, we're going to put your school uniform on, your shoes, you're going to have breakfast, we're going to get on the bus, we're going to go to school. I will pick you up from school, we can go to the shop, we'll go home. And if we were out for the day, we had to say, okay, we're going to leave the house at this time, we're going here first, then here, then here, then home. And we had to really structure the day and let him know in advance what to expect from his day. And that really helped a lot. And also, he was non-speaking for a while. His language was it wasn't very well developed until he was at like 7 or 8 years old. It was very hard to understand what he wanted. He wasn't really saying words. He was more like, you know, grunts or hisses or growls, or he'd be trying to speak and it'd be very difficult. And I'd be getting frustrated because I didn't know what he wanted. And as his mum, I was like, I feel I should know what you need. And I was getting frustrated. And so we learned to label things. And, you know, I'd say to him, show me what you want, rather than try to tell me. And that helped a lot. And as he's gotten older, I mean, like I say, he's 14. He's obviously started puberty. And I honestly thought, oh, here we go. We're going to have a real Kevin and Perry, you know, situation here. He's going to suddenly overnight, he's going to be this hormonal angry teen. And he's not. He's actually mellowed a lot. So when he was younger, he was needed a lot of guidance and needed a lot of structure. And he still needs his structure now. But as a teen, he's very laid back. He's very aware of himself. He knows he's autistic. So I made a point of telling him as soon as I felt he was old enough to understand it, I made a point of telling him that he was autistic. So, because I felt it was fair that he needed to know, and then he could help himself and advocate for himself. And so now we're still giving him structure, and I still have to explain a lot of things to him. And, you know, I'm trying to teach him how to be self-sufficient and independent, and give him more responsibilities that he'll need when he's older and he leaves the house or whatever. So I mean, at the moment, he's, you know, a typical teen. He'd rather sit at home on the Xbox all day, and he's more than happy to just do that, and we just let him do his own thing.
But do you fear that he might mask, whether it's at school or at home, and that could lead to what you had around a similar age of burnouts? Have you ever seen what you think might be burnouts in him?
To be honest, I don't think he does mask. I think because we've always told him that he's autistic. I think he's always been very aware of who he is. And as far as I'm aware, when I've seen him interacting with his friends, for instance, he's very like bright and bubbly, but he's like that with us. So I've never really seen a change in his behaviour with his friends. With us. So in that respect, I'm quite happy that he isn't masking with his friends, but I do feel he does mask with his teachers.
That's the thing, though, isn't it? When you're at school, your friends accept you, but teachers and other children who might not understand neurodivergence, or just, you know, you just get some that are just angry, unhappy children that want to lash out in school to people that they find are easy targets. So I wondered if, yes, he knows who he is, but does he sometimes, like a lot of us, mask because we know otherwise we're going to get a lot of stick or things we don't want to deal with? I mean, how does he manage? Some teachers really do not have the training or understanding. Oh. Has he had to encounter any difficult stuff?
I mean, he's been quite lucky with his teachers that, like, they know he's autistic, and he's under, like, the pastoral care, and he's under the care of the local outreach. So from that respect, his teachers have been really good with him, and they understand him, and they love him to bits. They think he's brilliant. I mean, he has had a couple of occasions where he's been bullied because he's different, I think. But he's took it in his stride. He's, you know, we've dealt with it. We've helped him through it. We've supported him with the emotional and mental toll that was taken. And he knows he's supported at home. He knows home's safe, and he knows he's safe with his teachers. He knows who he can go to at school. So I think I really do see a difference in him, that I really don't feel that he does mask, because I really do feel that he just goes about his day just comfortable in who he is, which I love about him. He just, yes, he gets picked on, but he doesn't hide who he is. You'd think being bullied, he would try to act differently, but he doesn't. And I don't know whether that's because he doesn't know how to mask, or because, I would hope it's because he's comfortable in his skin and he's comfortable knowing who he is and knowing that he doesn't need to try to be someone else, you know. But I do worry that when he gets older that, you know, he may struggle like I did, but I make a point of checking in with him all the time. And although obviously I haven't told him what I went through specifically, you know, he does know that I've been through a hard time, and he knows that he can speak to me about anything. But I haven't noticed any signs in him that he's depressed or that he's, you know, he's struggling. But he has told me on a couple of occasions when he's been feeling a bit, you know, when things have gone on at school or what have you. So I feel that he could talk to me about how he's feeling. And I would like to think that I know him well enough to pick up. I do pick up when he's quieter and when he shuts down, and we talk about it. And usually it's nothing like that can't be resolved in a chat. So I do feel that he's managing, but also I am very cautious that, you know, as he gets older and he has more responsibilities. But the difference between my son and myself is that he's got support in place in school that I didn't. And although I had supportive parents, he's got supportive parents, but he's also got the support of school, and he's got a good friend network. Whereas when I was at high school, I didn't have any friends that could really count, you know, that I could say were friends.
So he's had a good foundation, hasn't he?
Yeah.
From the off, which is really important. And I think that's why you said, like, a lot of us who never had that find it a lot more of a battle, and that's probably why we fight harder for our kids, because we don't want them going through that. But do you ever fear that with your daughter, who presents not stereotypically, and like you said, you've had challenges already trying to get her assessed, do you think that she might have a different experience with school and having to mask because people don't seem to understand that she, or even accept that she might have neurodivergence?
Well, again, like with my daughter, she has an EHCP because she was born with a rare birth defect. She was born with 17q12 microduplication, which is a rare genetic defect, and also she was born with a tracheal esophageal fistula and esophageal atresia. So when she was born, her esophagus stopped in a pouch at the top, and the bottom half joined onto her trachea. So at 2 days old, she had surgery to reattach the two halves of her esophagus. So for her, she's always been in and out of hospital having surgeries. And again, with her, she's got her EHCP for that. Because of the 17q12, she does have learning delays. And She's got a really good support at school. She's under the outreach. She's under a speech therapist, and the teachers are fantastic. The SENCO team at her school are phenomenal. And so she's the sort of girl who I really admire about her is we're so different yet so alike. I see myself in her in some ways, but in other ways, she's so outgoing, but naturally outgoing. She's very, again, she's very confident in herself and who she is. And although, again, she's had moments at school where maybe her differences have been picked up on and other children may have been trying to tease her, she's been able to go to her teachers about it. She's been able to talk to me about it. And I've been able to support her through it and just say, you know, you are who you are and you're brilliant. And I make a point of telling her, you know, you're smart, you're funny, you're loyal, you're kind. And just really hyping her up as a person. And I really do feel that she's comfortable in her skin. And so she's the sort, I used to call her my little firecracker when she was little because she was so feisty. And she still is. She's really outgoing, naturally outgoing. And she's very comfortable in her own skin. But also she knows that she can talk to myself and her dad about anything. And we can pick up when she's having a bad day and she'll talk through it, whereas I wouldn't. I'd just bottle it up and hide it. So in a way, I hope she carries on being comfortable the way she is. She's got a lot of friends. She's a very likable child. She has a lot of friends at school and she's confident, but I really, again, I don't feel that she's putting that on. She's very much herself. And if other children tease her about her being herself, she doesn't tend to dwell on it like I used to do. I mean, I've often thought I suffer with rejection sensitive dysphoria, whereas she sort of brushes herself off and she just picks herself up and gets on with the day. And so in that respect, I hope that never changes because I want her to carry on being comfortable the way she is now, you know. So, yeah, I mean, although as a parent, I'm still cautious and still looking out for signs that she may be struggling. But in all honesty, I really think because we've brought her up as if she was neurodiverse, I think that's given her more confidence in herself to realise she's not the problem.
Yeah.
That, you know, that other people may see her differently, but that isn't on her, that's on them. Mm. And I think, you know, so I think that's the positive, really.
And that's a really important thing. I think if there's any people, there's probably a lot of parents listening who are suspecting their children might be neurodivergent. And if so, they now want to start, you know, it's great to know that they could start putting these messages in now. It's never too late to start educating your children. I think, obviously, I found out my son was like 10. So it doesn't stop me. I'm always talking about it. He gets sick of it. But I think he's very accepting of it. Like he now spots things. He's like, Mama, oh, you're doing that ADHD thing again. Yeah, he's starting to understand those things. So I think he takes things less personally when I mess up or dysregulate and snap at him when it's not about him. It's because you've interrupted me while I'm mid-task and my brain cannot cope with that. And obviously I apologize, but it's that guilt. But now at least he's like, it's not just, I haven't done something wrong. It's her brain and how she can't deal with what I've just, So that's, I think, a really important thing. And I think what I fear is that, and your daughter sounds amazing, but obviously teenage years, I've read a lot about how neurodivergent traits can really start to get a lot worse at this point because of hormones. And, you know, it's almost like I have people in my network who, when they hit teenage years, you really started seeing autism, ADHD, and they had new traits they'd never had before.
Mm-hmm.
Some are really tricky and they're getting worse as they're getting slightly older.
Yeah.
And it's trying to navigate that. And that's why I asked about, but your son sounds like he went the other way. Like he's like, he just chilled out. I was like, wow.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. He has his moments, you know, he has his moments where I like being a stroppy teen. But then we work with him. And I find that with my son, when he was younger, he had a lot of meltdowns. Whereas now he tends to more have shutdowns. So he'll go quieter rather than lash out. But we work with that. Now I know what he's doing. I can spot it. And I know him, do you know what I mean? I know him. I think it's because we're both autistic as well. I can tell when there's something, when his tone changes.
Yeah.
And there's something on his mind. And I'll be like, you know, how are you doing? Are you all right? And he'll be like, yeah, fine. And I was like, I know he's not. And I know sort of when to push it and when to leave it. And when I push it, I'll just be like, look, you know, you don't seem quite yourself. Talk to me. What's going on for you? is there anything I can change or anything going on? And he'll open up, and half the time it's not anything major. It'll be a game he's been playing and the players took all his stuff and he's frustrated.
It's big, isn't it, to him?
But, yeah.
For us, it's like, really?
Yeah, and I'll be like, and I'll validate it, and I'll, you know, I'll validate his feelings. I'm like, look, that must be really tough for you. I can understand. That must be really frustrating. But I think part of me gets slightly triggered, because as soon as he shuts down, I'm like, oh gosh, here we go, he's depressed. And it's like, he's not, he's asking. And now, because I ask him outright, you know, what's going on for you, you know, talk to me. And he does, and we resolve it, you know. And I think that's what's helped him, is knowing that he can have a shutdown if he needs to. I'm not, you know, and I've said to him, when you feel like that, how can I help you? What do you need me to do? And he'll say, look, if I do that, he said, just leave me, sit with me, but don't touch me. Don't talk to me. Just be with me, but leave me to it. And because he's able to accommodate his own needs and speak out for what he needs, we found it easier to navigate his, you know, early teen years so far. And I know what he's told me, what works for him. I'm not thinking, well, this is what I would want if I was doing this, so I'll do that. I'm actually giving him a voice and saying, what works for you, we'll do that, you know. And I think that's helped a lot. Yeah,
that sounds brilliant. For those who don't know what they are, what is a meltdown and a shutdown, so they can understand the difference between the two?
So a meltdown, for a lot of people that aren't aware of what a meltdown is, it might seem like a child or an adult that's having a tantrum, maybe like crying, shouting, stamping. For my son, he would shout, be quite agitated, shout, run off, seem quite angry. And it's usually when you're overstimulated and everything's a bit too much, and it's hard to formulate sentences, it's hard to think clearly, think rationally. You just either want to escape. It's like the fight or flight, I suppose. You either, with my son, he'd want to fly, he'd want to hide, run and hide. Whereas myself, I'd lash out. And when I have a meltdown, I can't speak properly. Sometimes I go mute. I get very irritable. I can't stand to be touched. Can't stand anyone near me. I don't want anyone to talk to me. And for all intents and purposes, it looks like an overgrown toddler having a tantrum. You know, I actually look as if I'm having a tantrum. And it's not, because you're not in control of what you're saying and doing. It's because you're so overwhelmed. And a tantrum is usually because you want something and you're not getting it. And the behaviour is so that you get what you want, because people give you what you want to stop you hit that behaviour. Whereas a meltdown is involuntary. You can't help it. And I can only speak for, obviously, my own experiences with it. Everything becomes a bit too much. You just, you know, everything becomes very frustrating and everything becomes a bit too loud. You just want everything to just stop and just be quiet. I feel very flustered. So my son, he used to be like that. He used to be very lash out, very angry, and he'd just run off and hide and get out of the situation. He just wanted to leave that situation. Whereas now, as he's getting older, he tends to just shut down, where he will just not talk and not move. He'll just sort of sink into himself. And you can just tell that there's something going on. So, I mean, I have some shutdowns where I'll become nonverbal and I won't be able to move. It's almost like I'm just zoned out. And my son is a bit like that. He'll just go very quiet. You ask him questions, just get one word answers or no answer at all. And so I know to just leave him to it. And I remember from what he said, if I feel like this, he said, just sit with me. Don't touch me. Don't talk to me. And I do. And I'll just sit with him and I'll observe him. And then he'll take a deep breath and be like, right, this is what's going on for me. And then we talk it out. So I can only speak from my own experiences and from what my son has told me. That might not be everyone else's experiences, but that's my understanding of meltdowns and shutdowns.
Yeah, and like you said, it's different for each person. And I think I've also seen that shutdowns can also vary in length. So you can have small ones like that, and then when he's ready, he'll talk to you. Mm. And others can last for months. And I wonder, just me being me, if that is what doctors assume is depression.
Yeah,
because you do withdraw with a shutdown. You don't want to talk sometimes. You just want to do the same thing that's safe, like just watch the same program on repeat, because it's something you've seen and you know how it's going to start, end, and there's no surprises. You might only want to eat safe foods. You might just want to lay about, have no motivation. So I'm wondering if a sort of a longer term shutdown might have been what you had when you were younger, when you were trying to, you know, mask for so long. And I guess I don't know enough. I haven't gone into the loophole of, is burnout different to shutdown? Does shutdowns lead to burnout? You know, I haven't looked that far, but I'm sure I will. I'll probably do another episode on it. I'm just interrupting this episode to say thank you for listening. I really hope you like it so far. I don't make money from creating this podcast currently, and I've always wanted to keep it free, inclusive and accessible for everybody, so you can hopefully benefit from it as much as I do. It takes many hours to record, edit and maintain the podcast, and there are costs incurred through things like recording and editing equipment, maintaining it online and getting tech help where needed, which I do need sometimes because I'm not tech savvy. I know times are hard, but if you're in a position to donate the price of a coffee, or even lower than that, every little helps me to keep this podcast free and accessible for all. To donate, simply go to the link in our bio on this podcast service you're listening from, or go to the Linktree website and search for MindVoxPod. This link is also on the bio of our Instagram and Facebook pages, which are also found by searching MindVoxPod. For those not in a position to do any of this, which is absolutely fine, you can help by following and sharing the pod across social media, telling your friends about us, and rating and reviewing it wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you for listening, and please enjoy the rest of the episode. But I don't know your take looking back, now that you have the tools and the understanding of what your diagnosis was and is, looking back at teenage you who started to have what you thought was depression, what's your take on it now? What was going on for you?
To be honest, no, I think for myself, I think that shutdowns are more, like I said, they do vary in like duration, but I honestly feel that what I was going through was more burnout, where nothing was calming me, nothing was soothing me. With a shutdown, sticking to safe environments, safe routine, safe foods, the routine was really what helped me get out of that. Whereas I feel that it was more burnout, where I'd just gotten to a point, I just broke. I think I just broke down. I always said, like, you know, I had a nervous breakdown, I had a mental breakdown. And I really do feel that that at 17 was burnout. I just gotten to a point where absolutely everything was just way too much. I can see the similarity between that and depression, because I didn't want anything. Nothing brought me comfort at all. Even things that I enjoyed, I didn't want to do anything. I didn't feel worthy of anything. I didn't feel worthy of attention. I really felt like I was a burden on my family, on society, on my friends. I felt very numb, and like life was just passing me by, and I was just an autopilot going through my day, but nothing got through to me. Nothing brought me any joy. I was just literally on autopilot. I was getting dressed, going to college, eating, drinking, just going through the motions, but there was no emotion to me. I felt dead inside. I just felt, that's really the only way I can describe it. I just felt like I truly had enough, that everything was just too much.
And that does look like depression, doesn't it? From a doctor's point of view. But I think, you know, when you take antidepressants and nothing changes,
yeah,
is an indication it's something else, isn't it? And I mean, with that, I had a similar experience, but in 2017, but I was obviously in my 30s at that point, could not function at all, and those meds did nothing. So now I'm like, okay, that's what that was. And I think every few years after masking for so long, I will have what I assume is a massive depression bout, but it's probably burnout. And I think it sounds like you've had them on and off then ever since, and then doctors have given you meds and nothing's changed. So
yeah,
I think in terms of now you know what your conditions are, what do you do to try and prevent burnouts? Have you been given advice and support and to learn what to do so you don't keep getting them?
Not really, not from professionals anyway. A lot of it has been like my own research and online support groups where other people have expressed that they're going through the same thing or a similar thing, and everyone's very supportive, say like, you tried this or I do this. And a lot of it has been helping myself, you know, looking into things myself, because I got to a point where, especially after my attempt, that I realized that doctors weren't going to help me. I had to help myself. And now, I mean, I have had burnout recently. I was doing a job that took a lot out of me, and there was a lack of routine and consistency, and it got to a point where I lost my passion for my job and for my interests, and that was a big red flag. And I knew what was happening. And I thought back and I was like, I've been here before. I know how this ends or could end. And I'm not letting that happen anymore. And because I recognised it was starting, I quit the job that I was doing. I said, look, I can't do this anymore. I'm crying. Every time I log on to the computer, I'm crying. I'm not eating, not sleeping. I'm always anxious. I can't do this anymore. And I quit. And then a lot of it was just self-care and being gentler on myself and thinking to myself, right, you know what this is. You know why you feel this way. And so I sort of sat with it and I was like, okay, I know what this is now. And that's why I made the changes. I left that job and I would focus on more self-care. So picking up old interests that I'd put down in the past and doing mindfulness things like, you know, adult coloring books and things like that, just gentle things that didn't require a lot of mental thought or effort. And that's what really helped me get through it, really, was to just say, look, instead of trying to force myself out of it, I just sat with it and I was like, okay. And because I acknowledged it, I think that was the main thing, was acknowledging how I was feeling instead of fighting it, helped me to get out of it. And I know burnout can last for years, so I'm very much aware that I'm starting to come out of it now, but I'm also very aware that if I put too many responsibilities on myself that I know I'm not actually ready for, I know that I'll just sink right back down. So at the moment I'm advocating for myself and I'm asking for accommodations where I need them, and I'm no longer afraid to say, look, I'm struggling, I need you to do this for me, or I can't do this right now, or I need to do this. So I'm speaking up for myself finally and saying, look, I'm really struggling. This is what will help me. And I'm just doing things like that, which has really helped me out a lot. And so I've got a good supportive network. You know, my husband's fantastic. My parents are fantastic. I've got really good friends. But I think because I've got my official diagnosis, because I know now what it is, I can ask for accommodations. Whereas as a teen, I didn't know why I felt the way I felt. So I couldn't ask for help because I didn't know I needed to. Whereas now I do, and I do ask for help and I get it. And instead of waiting for other people to pick up that there's something amiss, now I'm like, I'll say to my husband, look, I'm having a really bad sensory day today. And I'll tell him what I need. Whereas back as a teen, I didn't know what I needed. So that's why I struggled so much.
And that's why diagnosis is so important, isn't it? Because people say, why now at this age do you need to have this label? And it's like, well, actually, then I can go and learn exactly who I am, how my brain works, what I need and what I should avoid, you know, all those sort of things that can help that however long I've got left, hopefully will be less painful and overstimulating than what I've had so far. So I think it sounds like you've now got that ability to say, I need this, I need that. And I wondered, it's quite scary that you said burnout can last for years, because I'm kind of in it now and I really don't like that thought. But it's like, if you are, like you are, a parent of two children who still need you, they're not, you know, they're not adults away from the nest. And, you know, people need to work. They can't just necessarily cut the job like me if they're a single parent as well. But they're going through burnout. Like, how can they put in boundaries? What sort of boundaries from your own experience would you recommend trying to put in whilst you've still got certain things you have to do, like parenting, maintaining your home if you're the only adult there, things like that?
So for myself, especially since I got diagnosed, I've been very open with my children about my diagnosis. And I said to my son, look, you know, I'm autistic too. And I've said to my daughter, look, I'm autistic. My brain works differently to yours. It works like differently to your brothers, to your dads. I said, and so if I was having a bad day and I was overwhelmed and overstimulated, in the past, I always felt I was quite grumpy and quite snappy. And I realised now I was overstimulated, but I didn't know that. So now I know that I'm overstimulated. I'll actually say to my kids, look, I'm feeling a bit overstimulated. I'm feeling a bit grouchy. Because they're quite young, I'll just say, look, I'm feeling a bit grouchy. Could you just give me 5 minutes? Just don't talk to me for a few minutes and I'll be okay. I just need a breather and I'll go outside for a minute. And because I'll say, like, can you just leave me alone for a few minutes? They're like, yeah, mum, fine, no problem. And they don't take it as me going, oh, just leave me alone. They don't take it as me brushing them off or ignoring them. They know I need a minute to regulate myself. And I'm a lot calmer since I started to do that, because before I'd get overstimulated and I'd get snappy and then I'd apologise and the mum guilt would kick in. And my daughter will even say to me now, she'll say, "Mum, just leave me alone a minute, don't talk to me." And I'd be like, "No problem, kid, I'll leave you to it." And I think that's brilliant.
You've role modelled that, haven't you? You've taught her those tools early. That's brilliant.
And I've taught her that it's okay to not want to talk and be involved with everybody. It's okay to be overstimulated, but it's, you know, advocating for yourself. And like I said, they know that I'm not ignoring them and I'm not pushing them away. I'm just saying, if you want me to be happy, mum, you really need to give me some space right now for a minute. I'll explain to them. I'll say, look, I'm feeling really overstimulated. So that for me, that means, and I'll explain how I'm feeling. And I'll say, I'm feeling a bit frustrated. I'm feeling a bit irritable. I'm feeling a bit touched out. And that's the thing as a parent, you know, you get touched out and you get talked out. And that's why I'll say, like, you just give me a few minutes. And they do, and they're fine with it. And I've started wearing my noise-canceling headphones around the house, which has made me feel a lot calmer because I love, like, the noise-canceling on. So I can still hear my children. I'm still present, but the noise is dimmed a bit. So it's not, I didn't realise how loud the world was. And I wear these, like, pretty much all the time. They're glued to my head. And when I don't wear them, the other day we went out together and I didn't charge them, so I couldn't wear them. And I was so overstimulated. I had a bit of a meltdown later on in the day because I didn't realise that how much, for instance, these headphones helped me with external noise. I didn't realise that that was such a trigger for me. And now since wearing them, I'm a lot calmer and it's easier to recognise when a meltdown's forming. Whereas before it just bubble up, I'd miss the warnings. I'd miss the feelings of feeling a bit overstimulated, and then it'd just spill over into a meltdown. And then nobody's happy because then I'm grouchy and I'm snappy and it wasn't fair on the kids. And so now I'm like, I can recognize it starting. And so I'll just say, look, you know, put things, boundaries in place. And I said, and the kids do it too. Like my son will go off to his room for a bit if he needs some time to himself, or my daughter will say, just don't talk to me for a minute. And I'm like, that's fine. And like if my husband, who comes in from work and he's got ADHD, and all he wants to do is just start talking at me about his day, which I love to hear about his day, obviously. But we've now set in place that I'll say to him, just give me at least half an hour when you come in, because I'm talked out, I'm touched out. I just need that half an hour where you just don't talk at me, because I'm thinking for three people at the minute. I said, I'm thinking for myself, I'm thinking for my son, I'm thinking for my daughter. I'm having to preempt what my daughter needs. I'm trying to, because my daughter is verbal, but she still struggles with the language. And so I said, I'm trying to preempt what she needs. I'm trying to think ahead for my son. I'm trying to make sure that his needs are met, because, you know, I'm still having to remind him to toilet and what have you, because his lack of interoception, he doesn't necessarily know when he needs to, you know, do things. And so I'm having to think ahead for him, think ahead for my daughter, think for myself. And I said, it's a lot. I said, by the time you get in from work, I said, I'm really overstimulated. I need that cool down period. And it's worked for us. I mean, if someone else's daughter said to him, don't talk to me, like in a snappy tone, they might be like, how dare you speak to me like that? You don't speak to your parents like that. But I'm not like that. I understand it's like, she's not snapping at me. She's overstimulated, so me shouting back at her isn't going to help any. And I still have my moments where the other day, a friend went in after playing and she was really frustrated. She was really overstimulated and she had a meltdown. Nothing consoled her. And I was like, and I could feel myself getting frustrated and triggered and getting overstimulated by it. And I just took a deep breath and I was like, this isn't me. It's not my issue. She's struggling. She's overstimulated. So I walked away and she initiated like a hug and I was like, right, okay, you know, that's what she needed. So it's all about learning what each other needs and trying to accommodate each other's needs and the boundary, respecting the boundaries.
And that can be hard, I think, when you've got, like you said, your own triggers, and if your children have triggers too, and then if some of them clash at times, it's like, how do you stay calm if you're being triggered to think, see what's happening and, oh, hang on, they're being triggered. Like you sound like you got it on lock, but with me, if I'm triggered and he's triggered, I'm rubbish at saying it until after that. Oh my God, why did I do that? That didn't help him. He was in his own anxiety or this sort of stuff and I've just made it worse. So I'm still trying to learn that, hang on, when I'm triggered, I need to get myself out of it pronto and calmly. And I'm just like 0 to 100. I'm not very good at that. So it's great that it's inspiring that you've managed to be able to see yourself as you're doing it quickly so that you can kind of step back and help them.
Yeah, I do have my moments where, like the other morning, I was worried like one of their pet rats, well, he's passed now, but I was worried about him and I had a lot on my mind and I've started this diploma and I've got a lot of thoughts going on in my head at the same time. And my daughter was overstimulated that morning. And I mean, I'm ashamed to admit, I did snap at her and then I felt awful, obviously, as you do. But what I found is when I have those moments where I don't catch myself and I do snap and I get irritable and I just lash out, I take the time to sit with my kids afterwards and say, look, I'm so sorry. I reacted like that because of this. I make it clear to them that I'm not excusing my behaviour. I'm explaining it. So I'm not saying, oh, well, I did that because I'm autistic. It's not that. It isn't an excuse. It's a reason. And I'd say, look, I said, this is what was going on for me in that moment. I'm sorry I reacted that way. And again, it's hard to apologise for something you're not in control of. But it's being aware that although it might be involuntary, it still has an effect on other people. And I still have a responsibility to own up to the fact that my actions still had consequences and that I have to, you know, I can't just be like, ignore that happened. So I'll sit my kids down. I'll say, look, I'm really sorry I shouted. I was really overstimulated. I should have taken myself away from the situation and calmed myself down. I was too overstimulated to realise what was happening until it was too late. And I do apologise for making you feel bad and for the way I reacted. Sometimes I can't help the way I act and it isn't personal and I'm sorry. And it's validating that their feelings and that it affects them. Even though I don't do it intentionally, I still accept and take responsibility for the fact that although it isn't voluntary, it does still affect others. And so it is on me then to explain the why behind what I've done. And they understand, like, my daughter now, bless her, she'll come up to me. She can tell when I'm getting overstimulated because I'll start flopping. Mm. The fingers will start going and I'll start stimming with my hands. And that's a warning sign for me too. When my hands start going, I'm like, hang on a minute, something needs to change because this is the first sign that a meltdown's coming. And she'll come up to me and she'll not touch me as well because I don't like sudden touch. Touch has to be deliberate. So like sometimes my husband will just brush my shoulder and I'm like, oh, could you not? You know, and he's like, what's up with you? And I said, the feel of the fabric just rubbed against my skin like it's just, oh, I can't. I said, so like touch has to be deliberate. And my daughter will come up to me and she can tell if I'm getting a bit overstimulated. And she'll come up to me and she'll say, Mum, can I talk to you? More often than not, I'll be like, yeah, of course you can. What's going on? What do you need? And sometimes I'll be like, actually, can you just give me a few minutes? And she's like, yeah, Mummy, and go off and do whatever.
You apologise and you take the time to go through all that. And actually what that's doing is validating them, but at the same time it's teaching them, because they're at some point in their adult life, they're going to do that too. They're going to snap at people they care about and have their own children possibly and do the same thing. So it's teaching them how to deal with that situation the way my mum did, and this is what I need to do, then teaching them. So that's really positive. And I think looking back, I know it's very early days still because it's a couple of years you've been formally diagnosed. Did you go through, or are you still going through, a grief process of, you know, what could have been and what's it been like since diagnosis?
I think I'm out of it now. I'm starting to get into the autistic and proud phase where I'm like, I'm autistic, deal with it sort of phase. But, you know, as soon as I got the diagnosis, it was like a weight was lifted. And I did go through like a grieving process, and it was more of it was disappointment, and it was sadness because it was like I didn't have to struggle. And I think that's what upset me most was the fact that for 42 years I'd gone through life doing things the hard way because that's all I knew, finding my own way and my own path because no one was doing it for me. No one seemed to know why I did the things I did, say the things I did, think the way I did. And so I realised that no one was coming to save me. I had to save myself. And when I got my diagnosis, I felt really sad because I was like, I didn't have to struggle. However, as a child in the 80s, 90s, having a diagnosis back then, I really don't think much would have changed. I really don't think I would have been any better off than I am now, because teachers didn't have a very good understanding of autism, and my peers would have just used it as more ammunition to bully me. And so that sort of helped to resolve that bit. And I was very cautious of having a pity party for myself and thinking, I don't know if I was a little bit hard on myself. I was thinking, yeah, but you're grown up now. You can't do anything about those. And I think that's what got me out of the grief phase, was thinking to myself, right, you can't change your childhood. You cannot change who you were back then. You cannot go back in time and fix things. You can grieve all you want for the time you've missed, but so what are you going to do now? And I was like giving myself a pep talk. And I was like, all right, yeah, you grew up undiagnosed. You were bullied. You struggled. Now you're diagnosed. What are you going to do about it? You wanted this diagnosis. Mm. So what are you going to do with it? And I was like, do you know what? I know what I'm going to do with it. I'm not going to waste any more time. That's what I'm going to do. Now I know who I am. I can work with myself now. I can work with this.
Mm.
And that's really helped me out. So now I'm very vocal about being autistic. I'm proud to be autistic. I wouldn't want to change myself now. If someone said to me, oh, I've got a cure for autism, would you take it? No, I wouldn't, because there's nothing wrong with being autistic.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not broken. I don't need to be fixed. But I also now, because I know I'm autistic, it was almost like a light bulb moment. And I was like, so that's why I do this, or that's why I think like that. And now I'm able to say, yeah, I do these things because I'm autistic. What of it? This is just who I am. This is how my brain works.
Yeah, it's a reason for it, isn't it? So you don't have to feel like I was just lazy, or I was just not, I didn't get it, or I couldn't do whatever. It's actual, no, I'm not lazy. I'm not less than. I'm not a freak, or like some people will refer to myself. I literally don't. My brain is wired completely different to how a lot of society is designed. So that makes a lot of sense. And what do you feel about functional labels? I mean, first of all, for people that don't know, what are functional labels within autism, and what's your view on them?
Oh, functional labels. And funnily enough, when I was diagnosed, they said the one who diagnosed me, she said, so I got the results over the phone, and then emailed me with the report. She said, well, you're obviously quite high functioning, because you've got a house, you've got a husband, you've got kids, and you've got a job. And I was mute. I was like, are you for real? A professional thing? Well, you must be high functioning because ABC. And I was like, I was dumbfounded. And I thought, part of me was saying, tear her a new one, you know? And I was like, and I just couldn't wait to get off the call. I was like, how ridiculous is that? So functioning labels is when someone says like, oh, someone's high functioning or low functioning. And what they really mean to say is someone has higher support needs or lower support needs. But I think with autism, the support needs, it could be dynamic. One minute, I might have low support needs, but in the space of an hour or in a day, my needs may be higher. I may need more support. And it depends on what situation I'm in, what's going on for me that day, or what's going on that week or month or what have you. My needs change from day to day, hour to hour. So I can go from low support needs to high support needs. But when people say like, oh, you're high functioning, it's very dismissive. So that lady was saying, oh, you must be high functioning because you've got a job, husband, house, kids. And I was like, what on earth does that mean? Really, when people say, like, oh, you're high functioning, what they're trying to say is, well, you don't look autistic, or you don't act autistic, or you don't act like you need support. So you're obviously doing okay, because there are other autistics who need 24-hour support, they're in residential support, or they need a carer with them that can't live independently. And you're not like that, so you're obviously not as autistic as they are. And it's ridiculous. And it's like saying, oh, you're obviously quite high functioning. But what she doesn't see is me having a meltdown. She doesn't see me getting overstimulated. She doesn't see me going mute when plans suddenly change. Or she doesn't see me shutting down when I touch a texture that I don't like, or when everything's a bit too loud. And this woman, she'd never seen me apart from like over Zoom. She had no idea what 24 hours in my life was like. She just saw on paper that I was seemingly functioning to, I don't know, I think when people say high functioning, I think what they're trying to say is you don't need support, or you don't seem that autistic sort of thing, which I think is ridiculous. And then say someone's like, oh, someone's like low functioning. It's like, oh, they need a lot of support, or they're less than.
It makes them feel like if I was called low functioning, so I don't function properly. You're saying that I can't do much. When actually, like you said, that's why I think, yeah, more people are using the supports here, because that is more accurate. No, I need more support to achieve things that other people might be able to achieve with less or no support. So it's but you know, the high functioning thing is like, no, I may have a house, a partner, a children, but you don't see at what cost. You don't see behind closed doors the struggles. You don't see the mental health conditions that people usually contract from having to try and work full-time in stimulating environments when they have autism or ADHD, when they're trying to parent on top of that and deal with bills that they're forgetting or missing, or, you know, all the doom piles. That they don't understand the cost, the anxiety, the trauma, the PTSD that people can end up having, or addictions, or sabotaging relationships because they can't cope, because they're not, because people are assuming you're high functioning, which I hate the word. You don't need help, so we'll leave you to it. Yeah. Actually, no, to maintain what you've achieved, there is some support needed. So it is, I think you're right, support needs is a better term, but sadly I'm still seeing a lot of parents with diagnosed children using the functioning labels because that's what their doctors and specialists are giving them, telling them that's what you say. And I don't think they understand how it comes across. But I'm hoping it's changing. I mean, do you think it's changing from things you see online? Are people starting to understand the narrative and the need to change that?
I think so. But for the majority, it is still very much, you know, I'll see parents saying, oh, my child's severely autistic, you know, or my child is just mildly autistic. Like, what on earth does that mean? You know, it's like, oh, they're mildly autistic. You're either autistic or you're not, you know, like you have higher support needs or lower support needs. You're not just a little bit autistic. I actually had a hoodie made that says touch of the tism on it.
Oh, I love that. I want one. How do I get one? I always say the tism. I've got the tism.
That's what I say when I do something now. So it's the tism. Yeah. I got the tism. And, you know, people say, like, it's like when other people who aren't autistic will say, oh, I'm so autistic, or oh, I've got a touch of the autism, a touch of the tism. And I'm like, that's no, that either you are or you're not. I'll be like, well, everyone's on the spectrum, aren't they? And you're like, well, no, like,
no, it wouldn't exist if we were all on the spectrum.
Exactly. I mean, you're either autistic or you're not. And yes, there is an autism spectrum. So if you're autistic, you know, like, I'm very different to my son. My son's very different to me. And, you know, you've met one autistic person.
Exactly. No two are the same, even in families. Everyone's it's a roll of the dice of what kind of traits are going to come out in you, isn't it?
Yeah.
And that's why some of the traits do require more support than others. Mm-hmm. Or some people mask better, so they appear like they don't need support until they have a major breakdown or burnout, and you realise, oh, there needed to be some things put in place there. And that's what, you know, you've sadly encountered, it sounds like. And now you've got the tools in place, but you've had to do the work. I mean, when you were diagnosed, did you get any support from mental health systems? You know, what's your view on how autistics are treated? Because mental health is not a mental health condition. It's a neurological condition. Especially the trauma of not knowing for 40 years, it can create anxiety disorders, the quite common OCD. You know, depression can come from not understanding yourself or the world not understanding you. I mean, have you had good mental health support since being given your diagnosis?
No. I've not had anything, to be honest. I was literally handed my diagnosis and I was like, right, you got your diagnosis now, bye-bye. And that was it. And I was left to it. And with my son...
So no support to learn how to navigate the world?
Nothing. I think there was a list of websites I could visit, and quite disgustingly, Autism Speaks was on there.
They're not good, are they?
They're very much of the viewpoint that it's something that needs to be cured or something that needs to be fixed. Right. So ridiculous. They claim to speak for autistics, but they don't. You know, it's a lot of autistics are against it because the mindset is very much of a, I think originally the puzzle piece, because they say it's like a puzzling condition, and the puzzle piece that they had a crying child on it.
Mm.
And you see, like, they do these adverts that be like, this is autism, It's deep, it's like a cancer in the family. It's doing this. It's like your child doing this. And if you see some of the adverts that they've done, they're disgusting. It's just horrible.
And that puzzle piece, isn't it, that it's trying to insinuate that
it was a puzzle.
You're missing
condition.
A piece. There's something you need to fix. Yeah, so that's completely wrong. That's why they've changed the puzzle piece for a lot of organisations that used to use that as well, didn't they? As the logo, it's changed, isn't it? Thank goodness. But why you've been inspired to do? Because obviously you were in pet bereavement, which is a form of therapy, but you know, have you been inspired to do your hypnotherapy now because of the lack of support you had? I mean, what inspired you to do it?
Yeah, definitely. Because I go back to like when I was 17 and like my attempt, and when I was in the hospital being treated, if you can call it that, it was very much, you're an attention seeker. And pretty sure I can remember one of the nurses saying, you're a very silly little girl, you know, and I was like, I'm suicidal. I'm not a silly little girl. I'm screaming for help and no one's helping me. This was my last resort. Listen to me, help me. And I was made out like I was just a troubled teen that was just seeking attention, not the teen that was desperate for help and just didn't see another way out. And it was, you know, I was supposed to see a community psychiatric nurse and no one came. So my poor mum and dad are having to try to support me through this. They're going through the trauma too. And there was no support. There was nothing, you know. So we're all trying to muddle through it together. And we did. And my mum and dad, I love them to bits. They're fantastic. And I really wish I hadn't put them through that. But looking back, I realised that it wasn't intentional. I'd just reached breaking point. And there was just no support out there at all. And so I decided to do this level 5 counselling and psychotherapy diploma, which the first year is hypnotherapy. And the next 2 years will be counselling and psychotherapy.
Oh, so it's a mix. It's not just therapy. So kind of counselling, what model is
so
it?
So it's integrative. So there'll be a few models like integrative or pluralistic. So there's a few different models combined, which I like the idea of, because you have a toolbox then of modalities that you can use as and when. And so like I said, the first year was hypnotherapy, which I'm really enjoying. And what I would like to do when I qualify is my niche that I would like to specialize in is suicidal autistic teens, because that's who I was. I want to be the support I wish I'd have had back then. I want to be the person that truly gets it. And that's why I did the pet bereavement counseling, is because pet bereavement is still one of those topics where people still don't get it. And I couldn't stand that. I couldn't stand the thought that people were so upset and not receiving support. And so I wanted to do this counselling training because I was an autistic teen. You don't grow out of autism. You know, it's a lifelong thing. It's the way your brain's formed and wired. You don't grow out of it. I didn't suddenly hit 18 and suddenly I wasn't autistic anymore. I want to be the support that these teens or adults that they need. And because I'm autistic myself, who better to support someone that's navigating their autism than a fellow autistic?
Because when I've been looking into sort of therapies at the moment, I feel like I'm at a stage where I do desperately need some. But I think I've gone through so many types over the years before I knew I was neurodivergent. And now I'm seeing that actually that's probably why they didn't work very well, because the neurodivergent brain apparently works better with specific types of therapies. I've heard somatic therapies, DBT, there's now a new one, which is
DBT,
RODBT, which is specifically for people with autism, PDA, those sort of things. Now, I'm wondering, the course you're doing, does it give you specific tools for autistic brains?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not quite sure of the syllabus for the counselling training. Like I say, obviously, we're only doing the hypnotherapy at the minute, but I have found that things like CBT, which is like, you know, trying to retrain your brain, and doesn't work, like I said, doesn't work for neurodiverse folks, because our brains don't work the same way as a neurotypical brain does. So yeah, DBT, there is actually a really good workbook I think DBT neurodiverse workbook that somebody had brought out.
Yeah, I've got that and I haven't started it. It's on my desk. Is it the neurodivergent friendly workbook of DBT skills?
Yeah, that's the
I
one.
Will
yeah.
put a link to that directly in the show notes if people want to click it and have a look and see if they want it. Because yes, I've got it. I've done one page and then my ADHD
I bought it.
Done,
and
no,
I've not, exactly.
But loads have said it's amazing. So it's on my desk because I actually have to try and start doing it pronto. Yeah. And I've had it for about 6 months. I think and I've heard integrative, I can't say that properly, can be helpful for some, and it's so you've got that within there, but like you said, the fact that you are autistic means I think even if you didn't learn specific therapies, you can probably adapt the therapies you learn to ensure people get what they need from it, because you're going to want to work with people that specifically had situations and traumas that you have had. So that sounds brilliant, and I think I'm really impressed that you're doing that. And hypnotherapy is quite somatic in some ways, I think. It is about being in the moment, isn't it? And
it is.
Mindful stuff, from what I remember from sometimes I've had it for students in the past, actually.
Yeah.
I found it quite intriguing to kind of, because I struggle with being in the moment. I'm always 5,000 steps ahead and behind at the same time. So how are you finding the hypnotherapy? Have you had it? How are you having it being done on yourself as well while you're training?
Yeah. See, the thing is, I'm pretty sure that I struggle with aphantasia, so I find it very difficult to picture a mental image in my mind. If someone says to me, imagine a pink elephant, I know what an elephant looks like and I know what pink is, and so in my mind it's more of the idea of what it should look like rather than actually seeing it as if it was in my head, if you know what I mean. So when we've been doing the hypnotherapy training, our tutor will say, one of the exercises they did was called a PMR, which is progressive muscle relaxation, which is what we do to get someone really relaxed and ready for hypnosis. And she said, right, everyone close your eyes, get comfortable. So we're doing it. And then she said, imagine a bright, warm light above your head. And everyone's like, right, okay. And I'm thinking, well, what kind of light? Is it a heat lamp? Is it a sun? Is it a star? What kind of light? What kind of light am I supposed to be imagining? And all I could picture was a heat lamp like you put over chicks or reptiles. And then she said, you can feel this warm light come down on top of your head. Like, right, so I'm being clumped on the head by this heat lamp, right? And it really put me off because I couldn't follow along with what she was saying. I was like, I don't know what kind of light. You've not told me what light it is. You need to be specific. And everyone else is like, oh, yeah, it was just like the sun. And I was like, I'm not getting that.
It needs more detail. I think. So you could be like the neurodivergent-friendly hypnotherapist. That would be amazing.
Well, it's really funny because, like, we practice on our peers and on volunteers. And so I have had hypnosis, like, myself, and I find it good. And there's different styles. So there's, like, authoritative, which is, like, very direct. Like, you will feel like this. You are feeling you are. Then there's, like, permissive. It's, like, you know, you may find yourself or... if you want to, you know, very, very free willed and all that. And so I found that hypnosis, it's like I've been listening and it's like I'm taking it in. But what I found my tutor saying to me, which is quite funny, is that I think I'm the only autistic in my class. But what I found is that she said to me, the questions I ask her, she'll say, you want things to be like a recipe, it has to be step by step. You need to know what's coming next. And she said, and hypnotherapy isn't really like that. It's more of a bit of this and a bit of that and going with the flow and being sometimes ad-libbing things and just going with the general feeling and adding things in. And I was like, but that doesn't really work for my brain. So for instance, at the moment, we're learning about suggestions. So we do the relaxation, we do a deepener, it's like we count down from 10 to 1. You're in your happy place, and then we give the suggestions. And I'm like, how many suggestions? And they said, well, we don't know, it could be any. Well, that's no good to me. How many suggestions should I be putting in? And they're like, well, it could as many as you like. It's like, I could quite easily give an A4 page of it suggestions, but that isn't going to help the subconscious, is it? So I've had to say to my tutor, like, you know, what specifically do you want me to do?
Yeah, they need to get on this. They need to be a bit more neurodivergent friendly when they're teaching, because they're bound to have some others that might not even know they're divergent.
Which is very good. And she understands it, and she said, like, I love the way you think. She said, you're very thorough. And I was like, I said, well, it's autism, isn't it? That's just part of being autistic. I'll go down these rabbit holes, and I love it. And I love, and a lot of this course is self-study, and I love it. And when I've been doing work with my peers, and they've said, and I'm pretending that they're a client, and I'm saying, I'm explaining the process of how this will work and what they can expect. And they said, you know, I loved it when you did that. You told me what to expect, and I honestly felt prepared. And I said, yeah, because that's what would work for me, like telling me what will happen, not just saying, you're going to relax and I'm going to tell you these things and then you're going to be hypnotized. I want someone to say, this is what I'm going to, I'll do this first. And then these are the reasons I'm asking these questions. This is how you may feel. This is why I do it. And people said, oh, I like that you do that. And I said, well, I don't know how else to be to do it. So I would like to think that my like being autistic, I can incorporate that into my therapy and, like I say, put things in place, you know, because I mean, it works for neurotypicals and autistics, you know, it's for everybody, it suits, you know, a lot of people.
Exactly. That sounds brilliant. I'm really excited that you're doing that. And hopefully, if you learn any interesting things from your training over the next few years of it, maybe you'll come back and talk about your findings and how it relates to our community as such. Yeah. But do you have any socials or a website if anyone wants to find out what you're doing, or, you know, read what you do? Are you on socials? Because, you know, even hearing your story now, I'm like, I want to hear more.
Do you know, I don't, to be honest, at the moment, mainly because of like burnout. I'm trying not to have too many things like on the go, but I have considered setting up like a Facebook page for my hypnotherapy travels and and I might do something about that. So I don't, to be honest. But I mean, if anyone's interested in like the pet bereavement side of things, I do have a podcast, which I've only done like 13 episodes, and I really need to get back into it, called the All Creatures Great and Gone podcast.
Okay, brilliant. I'll put that on the show notes so people can find that.
So there's that. I mean, I don't mind people emailing me, you know, if you want to get in touch.
Well, do you need any volunteers on, you know, Zoom or anyone when you're doing your practice? So if anyone hears this and wants to give hypnotherapy a try, they could email you, and I'll put that in the show notes then.
Oh, that'd be great. I am looking for, I need to get my hours up of practice. So at the moment, because I'm halfway through my training, I can work with low-level anxiety and phobias and habits. There are certain mental conditions that I can't work with at this level because I'm a student. So things like, you know, someone had like dementia or schizophrenia or bipolar, or there are other conditions that affect how the mind works rather than it being wired differently, that would mean that I'm not able to work with certain folks. But yeah, low level anxiety, habits and phobias. But yeah, if anyone's interested, it's free because I'm a student, I can't charge. So, you know, yeah,
I like it.
That
sounds brilliant. No, I'll definitely put that in, because I think there might be some people who will listen to this thinking, well, I have a bit of anxiety, that'd be perfect for me, or a phobia that I cannot stand. That'd be amazing. Thank you so much for doing this. It was really, I could talk to you for hours about this, but I'm aware that I'd have to edit it after. And I think it's really, we need to get more of a narrative really going on, particularly late diagnosed autism. I know we're getting a lot about late diagnosed ADHD. I'm one of those people talking about it, but I think, and even more so for me, when you have both, I think I need to see and hear more about people that struggle with both conditions attacking each other today. That's my next theory. But thank you for being so open. It's been really, really inspiring to hear how you've navigated things and what you've learned. And hopefully we'll have you back at some point.
Thank you so much.
If you've liked this episode, please help us out by following or liking the podcast, rating it, or leaving us a review, as this really helps us to reach more people that will benefit from hearing it. To help the pod remain free to access, please consider donating the price of a coffee if you're able to, which can be done via our link tree with the username MindVoxPod. This link can be found in the show notes of this episode and the bio on our Instagram and Facebook by also searching MindVoxPod. If you have ideas about topics to cover on future episodes, have any questions about the pod, or you want to be interviewed for it, please get in touch on socials or email us on mindfoxpod@gmail.com.